You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, broadcasting to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, Israel opens two new aid corridors to Gaza, but are Netanyahu's concessions enough to satisfy the US? And will calls for a snap election come to anything? Prague warns that Russia is trying to destabilise Europe's rail network. We'll get more on the cybercrime worries. Then,
I'm Guy Delaunay, Monocle's man in the Balkans, and I'll be digging up the details on Tito's grave and why three different cities are vying over his final resting place.
Plus, we'll have a roundup of news from the drinks industry. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. Israel has announced it's opening new routes for humanitarian deliveries into Gaza after a warning from US President Joe Biden that it must protect civilians. Well, joining me, Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent and author of How Long Will Israel Survive? The Threat from Within. Greg, many thanks for joining us once again. Biden's tense call with Netanyahu after the killing of those aid workers in Gaza attached conditions for future support of Israel. Can you tell us more about what was said?
I think it tells you just how much influence America has over Israel when it chooses to use it. President Biden said essentially that America's future relationship with Israel in terms of things like military support would depend on Israel taking measures to increase the flow of humanitarian aid to Gaza and also to protect civilians in Gaza.
And how did Israel react?
Well, within a few hours of that call, Israel announced, as you said, that it was opening new aid routes into Gaza. The most significant parts of the announcement first, that they are opening the Erez crossing for the flow of aid. This is a border crossing in the northern part of Gaza. It hasn't been used. It's been closed since October 7th. Connected to that, they're also going to allow aid for Gaza to flow through the port of Ashdod, the second largest port in Israel. It's about a 40-minute drive up the road from Erez Crossing. Israel had refused until now to allow any maritime deliveries to come through its own ports, which is why everything had to go either through Egypt or these sort of makeshift jetties that America and Cyprus and various NGOs are building in Gaza. So if they follow through on this pledge, allowing aid to go through Ashdod should allow for much bigger volumes of aid to be delivered by sea.
Mm. Now, Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's rival and colleague in the war cabinet, called for a snap election, and thousands have been marching within Israel demanding a fresh poll. What needs to happen administratively for this to take place, and is there any chance that it will?
That's the problem, is the administrative question. I mean, when he calls for early elections, he is speaking for the vast majority of Israelis. Just about every poll says 70 to 75% of Israelis want to see Netanyahu gone. They want to see a new election. The problem is that to call that election, the Knesset, the parliament, needs to pass a no-confidence motion. That can't happen at all for the next 6 to 8 weeks because the Knesset is recessing. It's taking its spring recess, and the summer session isn't due to begin until the end of May. So no business can happen until then. And then once it does reconvene, you still need to convince five members of the governing coalition to vote for that no confidence motion. And then even if that happens, there's usually about a 90-day lag between dissolving the parliament in Israel and holding a new election. So if the Knesset were to dissolve itself in late May or early June, we'd be looking at probably September at the earliest before an election could take place.
And is there anybody untarnished by this war that could take over from Netanyahu?
Gantz is the current favorite in the polls. He would likely win a plurality of the seats in parliament, and he would be able to form a coalition of about 65 or 70 Knesset members in the 120-member parliament. I think the question is whether Gantz would be able to stay in office for long or whether he would serve as a sort of transitional figure. He's not the best politician. He's a career military man. He's somewhat new to politics and hasn't always been the most adept politician. And he would have to form probably a quite unwieldy coalition that would span from the left to the center right, perhaps even the right. So it's not clear how long he would be able to hold that coalition together. He might replace Netanyahu, he might get rid of Netanyahu, but he might not be a long-lived figure as prime minister if he were to win.
And just in terms of Netanyahu's position in the polls, we know that ultra-Orthodox Jews lost the special legal status, I think on Monday, which allowed them to benefit from government subsidies and to be exempt from military service. How badly will that knock Netanyahu's support base?
That is right. It's one of the issues that actually threatens him with his base. Having the ultra-Orthodox serve in the army is something that amongst Israeli Jews, there is broad agreement on that. They would like to see ultra-Orthodox Jews drafted into the army. But of course, their quite influential political parties have been able to oppose that for decades. Now, there had been some talk that if this law wasn't renewed, if a new law wasn't passed that would continue their exemptions, that their parties might bolt the coalition and bring down the government. I'm not sure they're ready to do that quite yet. I think first, because even though this law has now lapsed, the army is not about to start drafting huge numbers of ultra-Orthodox Jews overnight. And also because they know if they bring down the coalition, there's a good chance they won't be in the next coalition. They'll be in the opposition, and then they'll be obviously in a very difficult position trying to pass a new law. So I think for now, they might hang in for a while and see if they can convince the government to pass a new version of this law. But it's putting more strain, certainly, on the prime minister's coalition.
The Washington Post has a wonderful line in it today talking about the existential loneliness of Israel. And I wonder if the easing of these humanitarian conditions in Gaza might deflect some of the international condemnation of Israel and that loneliness.
Broadly speaking, I'm not sure it will. And if you look at just about any measure, if you look at polls of people around the world, if you look at how countries have voted in UN General Assembly or Security Council resolutions, the vast majority of the world wants this war to end. And that is why Israel is so isolated at the moment. I think narrowly what the Israeli government is hoping is that by approving these new measures on aid deliveries, they will satisfy the Americans, they will satisfy a handful of other Western allies, at least at a political level. And, you know, if they do this, Joe Biden and Rishi Sunak and a few other heads of state might stop being so critical of Israel. But I'm not sure beyond that it's going to have much impact on global opinion.
Greg, thank you very much indeed. That was Greg Karlstrom. Now, here's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. The United Nations Human Rights Council has adopted a resolution calling for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip. Israel's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva has accused the council of having long abandoned the Israeli people and long defended Hamas. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says concerns are growing over the global economic fallout from China's excess manufacturing capacity. She made the comments at a meeting of foreign business leaders in Guangzhou as part of a four-day visit to the country. Mrs. Yellen is the first cabinet-level official to visit China since President Joe Biden met Xi Jinping last November. And Samsung says it expects profits for the first 3 months of the year to jump by more than tenfold compared to 2023. It comes as prices of chips have recovered from a post-pandemic slump and demand for AI-related products booms. The South Korea-based company is the world's largest maker of memory chips, smartphones and televisions. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you, Emma. And that's our last show together. It's been a pleasure working with you and we all wish you luck with whatever lies ahead. The Transport Minister of the Czech Republic says that Russia has made thousands of attempts to interfere with European rail networks. Well, I'm joined now by Rob Cameron, who's a journalist in Prague. Rob, what exactly has the minister said?
Well, the minister, Martin Kupka, has said, as you say, that Russia didn't actually point the finger as to whether it was Russian authorities or hacking groups associated with Russia had made thousands of attempts to disrupt European infrastructure, including the railways. He said concretely in the Czech Republic, there were cyber attacks on signaling systems and other networks that were attempting to affect the running of the Czech railways. These, he said, had followed on from previous attacks, which disrupted ticketing systems and did raise concerns that this would also have the potential to affect signaling and things like that, which is obviously an extremely serious allegation if it is indeed true. He did say, though, that he was proud of the way that the cyber authorities in the Czech Republic had reacted, and they were able to defend all of Czech railways systems against these attacks. So what he's talking about is attempts in the Czech Republic to disrupt the country's state railway network.
And beyond, I mean, he's worried about the whole of Europe. But what would the motive for this be then? Why does he say Russia's doing it?
Well, he hasn't said exactly why Russia would be doing it, but there is certainly a presumed link between recent actions by the Czech government, which has sanctioned two individuals, one of whom is a pro-Russian Ukrainian politician, and are also people who are behind a news website that's based in Prague called voiceofeurope.com. And that's been accused of trying to orchestrate a pro-Russian influencer campaign across Europe ahead of the European elections. That's what the Czech Foreign Ministry is saying. So perhaps there is some suggestion that these attacks are related to that and the Czech attempts to push back against Russian propaganda and Russian influence operations. But I think it's important to put this in context as well, because last year in the Czech Republic, in August, we had a number of cyber attacks on the nation's banks. Pretty much all the major banks in the country and even the Czech National Bank were subjected to the so-called DDoS, in this distributed denial of service attacks, when websites of major banks were inundated with requests by servers. The Czech authorities said then that these attacks were definitely coming from Russia. And then it soon transpired that a Russian hacktivist group called No Name 57, which is believed to be close to the Russian intelligence services, had admitted responsibility for them. And they said in admitting that responsibility that that was a direct response to various Czech fundraising and crowdfunding efforts to help the Ukrainian armed forces in their campaign against Russia. So there's clearly a link there.
And this, I mean, this latest attempt, as you say, to disrupt the railways didn't succeed. But had it done so, what would the impact have been?
Well, it could have been huge. We have seen, obviously, this country has invested an enormous amount in transport in the 3 decades since the fall of communism in 89. But there have been a number of very, very serious, fatal accidents on the rails, one involving a high-speed passenger train that crashed into a bridge that had collapsed moments earlier. The bridge was being repaired. And there have been a number of accidents involving signaling as well. Of course, not suggesting this has anything to do with outside actors and hostile states, but clearly this country, as perhaps all European countries, are vulnerable to having their safety and security systems tampered with. And the consequences of that, of course, can be devastating and fatal.
And I mean, it's not just transport that's at risk. You mentioned banks, but what other sectors are vulnerable to cybercrime?
Well, we see not only cybercrime, Georgina, in this country. I mean, if you cast your mind back to 2014, when there was an attack on a Czech arms dump in a fairly remote part of the country that left two people dead. There was a massive explosion as an enormous amount of ammunition being stored there went up in flames, and it caused damage across the area, and two employees died. And it later transpired that the Russian authorities, the Russian GRU unit that was behind the Sergei Skripal poisoning, that these two guys, these infamous tourists who went to visit that cathedral in the UK, that they were in the Czech Republic to orchestrate and carry out that attack on a Czech arms dump. And that was, we believe, linked to early efforts to resupply Ukraine with weapons following the annexation of Crimea and what was happening in the Donbass. So, you know, back then that led to a major response from Prague, which expelled dozens of Russian diplomats. So clearly many people in the security services here and analysts believe that this country is essentially, I mean, you know, at war is perhaps a strong term, but they are fighting an adversary in Russia. And those attacks, in the sense of it being a hybrid war, are taking all sorts of forms. And cyber attacks can obviously be extremely serious.
Mm. And how is the fight back going? How are the networks protected? And does more need to be done? I mean, will Russia at some point succeed in terms of the hacking side of it?
It's very difficult to say, isn't it? Because obviously the Czech officials are quite cagey about giving too much away. And generally, we only find out about an attack when it succeeds and when something goes wrong, such as the DDoS attacks on the banks last year, which, again, were quite limited because in the end, you know, no one in this country lost money. It wasn't kind of a phishing operation. It was simply bringing down the websites and the online banking systems of these banks. So it wasn't, it didn't, no one actually suffered any damage. Rather, it was just the inconvenience of not being able to access your mobile banking or your online banking for a few hours as they sorted it out. And they did say, no, we have, you know, many systems in place and we're introducing more to protect Czech infrastructure against attacks by hostile state actors. And it's clearly something that's very, very high up on the list of priorities for this government in the Czech Republic, and I think for all governments across Europe.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. That's Rob Cameron there, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, hugely controversial in life, Yugoslavia's former leader, Josip Broz Tito, remains a source of argument decades after his death, as three cities are vying to house his remains. Well, I'm joined now by Guy Delorne, who's Monocle's Balkans correspondent. Guy, lovely to speak to you again. Where are Tito's remains at the moment, and why can't he just rest in peace?
Well, that's a question lots of people are asking, Georgina. And, you know, like when we say that three cities are vying for him, this isn't like the Olympics or anything like that. It's not something that people were expecting. This has all been kicked off by the mayor, or should I say acting mayor of Belgrade, Aleksandar Šapić. But to rewind to your question, he's currently in Belgrade and he's in a place called the House of Flowers. And this is sort of half museum, half mausoleum. And Josip Broz Tito lies there in a marble tomb next to his wife, who only died a relatively few years ago, but he's been there since 1980. And the House of Flowers is a major attraction in Belgrade. Serbian school children from all over the country will stop off there to learn about Yugoslav history. And, of course, if you're a foreign visitor, it's one of the obvious places to go. And you can see the collection of batons that were there. And this is like, if you think of a relay baton, a pre-Olympics relay baton. Well, they used to have this sort of idea every year in Yugoslavia. The young people of the country, called the pioneers, would go around the country with this baton, you know, through all the different republics, Bosnia, Slovenia, Croatia, et cetera, and then they'd end up in Belgrade and they'd hand it over to Tito in a stadium, you know, reinforcing that there was unity under the great man. And that was the idea. But now, as you say, his rest may be disturbed.
Can I just ask you, before we look at who wants his body, what form the remains are in? I mean, what is it that people are going to see? Presumably, we're not looking at his corpse.
No, you're not. You're looking at a big chunk of marble, basically. You know, big marble box. You know, but it's raised up on a plinth. It's not like it's anything that's buried in the ground. And you're aware that Tito is in there.
Yeah.
But it's not like we're looking at any sort of mummified remains or anything like that, Georgina.
So who wants his body and why?
Okay, so let's first of all, I think, start with who doesn't want his body, which is Belgrade's mayor, Aleksandar Šapić. And Mr. Šapić has decided to go down the Serbian nationalist ultra-right route, it would seem, with this one, because he's trying to cast Tito as an enemy of the Serbian people, describing him as an Austro-Hungarian soldier who shot at Serbs in the First World War and then, post-Second World War, prevented the Serbian people from achieving their greatest flowering, which is, would be this sort of mythical idea of the Greater Serbia. So rather than having the Yugoslav Federal Republic as was, he would have had this Greater Serbia, where all the Serbs in the areas covered by Yugoslavia would be together in one Serbian state. And this is a dream of Serbian nationalists. And here's Mr. Šapić making it pretty clear that he's one of those. He's saying, I think we should send Tito to his birthplace, which is Kumrovec in Croatia. Croatia, not best known for its love of Yugoslavia or indeed anything Serbian. However, the mayor of Kumrovec has said, yes, please, we will have Tito, thank you very much, because we've got a museum here which attracts a small number of visitors every year. But if we had Tito's remains, I reckon we could get 1 million visitors a year, and wouldn't that be great for our economy? Finally, we've got Sarajevo, and Sarajevo has gone the full anti-fascist route, and they've said, well, Tito was the ultimate anti-fascist, and Sarajevo is the ultimate anti-fascist history. We want him here, and we will honour his anti-fascist legacy, and that's coming from the Prime Minister of the Canton of Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So that's those are the stakes, Georgina.
I mean, he was controversial in life. What do people... Is there one unified way that people think of Tito now?
And that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, we've just seen there, there's three different ways of looking at it in just those three different places. I think in Belgrade, I mean, Mr. Šapić, it's quite interesting that he's going for the ultra-right in Belgrade, because Belgrade is not known as an ultra-right place. And we are going to have these elections in June where basically the Green Left are going to be trying to get out the vote to oust him. Assuming that they don't boycott the thing, which is also a possibility. We can probably go into those reasons on another item, on another show, Georgina. But, you know, it's an odd thing for him to do. He's going for, you know, trying to plump perhaps his voter base here by talking about such things. Because you get Yuga nostalgia, of course. People are aware that there was something greater about Yugoslavia that a collection of individual nation states cannot touch, and a lot of people are quite sad about what happened. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who, however they feel about Yugoslavia and the feelings of brotherhood among fellow Slavs, see in Tito someone who was a dictator who was quite happy to have political opponents assassinated or exiled. So, you know, there's a multifarious views that you can take on Josip Broz Tito, and people take them indeed.
As you say, we are basically talking about a hunk of marble. Anything could be in there. Why is his body a tourist attraction?
Well, as I say, it's not about the hunk of marble itself, but what it stood for, and this idea of Yugoslavia, and this idea that's been lost. Because if I can go back to when I was studying the history of this, Pan-Slavism was an important movement for the Slavic people of the Western Balkans, and it was an ideal. And Serbia was seen as leading the way in terms of Pan-Slavism because they were the Slavic state which had achieved their independence. They were neither under the Ottomans nor the Habsburgs nor anybody else, and they were seen as showing the way. And that was why the Slavs of the Western Balkans united in Yugoslavia. And you won't be surprised, though, Georgina, that started going wrong very quickly. Even in the 1930s, you had Croat nationalists who were arranging the assassination of the King of Yugoslavia. So this is what people are looking into here, the very complicated history of the region and the role that Tito and the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which lasted from basically 1945 to 1991, played in all of that.
Guy, thank you very much indeed. That's Guy Delaunay. And you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. It's Friday, and though a little early in the day for me, let's talk alcohol. Patrick Schmidt is Master of Wine and the Editor-in-Chief at The Drinks Business, and he's on the line now. Hello to you, Patrick.
Good afternoon. Hello.
You have news of the most consumed spirit in the world. What is that?
Hey, right. Okay. I'm glad you started with this, because this is the thing about it. It's a brand called Mai Tai, but actually the spirit is called Baijiu, And it is the most popular spirit in the world, and yet it's something that very few people have drunk, unless you live in China, where it's almost entirely consumed. And in fact, I think there's more baijiu consumed in the world than whiskey, rum, and vodka put together. But pretty much all of it's consumed in China.
And that's extraordinary. Have you tasted it? What's it like?
And yeah, I was hoping you were going to ask me this. Years ago in Hong Kong, I was handed a glass of Mai Tai. And I have to say, it is a bit of a shocking experience, the first sip. It's pretty fiery. It's kind of earthy. It forms part of a Mai Tai that's known for its sauce aroma. So it does smell a little bit like kind of Chinese soy sauce or pickled cucumber, mushroomy, earthy scents. And it's very strong. So it is a bit of a shock to the system. I think the real shock for me the first time I tried it wasn't so much the flavor. It was the fact that afterwards I was told that a bottle of the stuff I just practically spat out was costing about £300.
Wow.
So it is a high margin, high priced product that's pretty fiery. But I suppose your first glass of single malt is a bit of a shock too.
Mm. Well, the company itself is worth a huge amount, particularly when you compare it to other alcohol groups.
That's the extraordinary thing. I mean, it's not at its peak value. So I think we put on the drinks business, it's worth about 300 billion. It was worth more than that, more like 400 billion a few years ago. But that was before the Chinese government really cracked down on the kind of gift giving and state banquets that used to take place, where a lot of Mai Tai would have been consumed or given as kind of semi bribes in a way. Mm. But yeah, if you look at Diageo, which is considered the kind of Western world's biggest drinks company, it owns big brands like Johnny Walker and Smirnoff or Bailey's. That's worth about 80 billion. So it really blows even, you know, the biggest drinks company in the world that we know of out of the water.
Mm. And if people balk at that taste that you just described, apparently there's a chocolate one coming.
Right. So that's exactly, they're trying to get the younger generation into baijiu. And the best way to do that, and with a lot of fiery spirits, is to mix them. Either you mix them in cocktails, which baijiu doesn't massively lend itself to, or you mix it with other things, so chocolate, ice cream, coffee too. So yeah, that's just one way to I suppose, make it a bit more palatable and bring it to the mainstream and a younger audience.
Hmm.
Now, which is partly why it's rising in popularity.
There's always news stories about alcohol and health, usually dire warnings, but we have a positive one here.
Right, yeah. So I was pleased that we looked at this one. So this chap, he's a Venezuelan, Juan Perez, and he died on Tuesday at the age of 114, almost 115. And there are a couple of things that moved me about this or pleased me. One was his, I found very moving actually, as a hopeless Catholic, but his Catholic face, that he said that you should love God and always carry him in your heart. But the other thing that he credited his long life to was his daily drink. He had a daily shot of what is effectively brandy, a strong spirit, aguardiente in Venezuela where he lived. And not only had he lived to almost 115, but he'd fathered 11 children, and I think he was great-great-grandfather to 12. But I think the message here is that moderate alcohol consumption can form part of a healthy and long life, despite all the warnings.
And finally, take us to Bordeaux, where winemakers are furious. Why?
Yeah, so they're... Bordeaux is being sold in French supermarkets for less than €2 a bottle. It's part of multi-deals. But basically, it's a long-running upset that's in French wine production and agriculture more broadly, which is really that the cost of production isn't being met by the prices being paid by the big buyers, which in the case of France are the big supermarket groups. And that's because in wine, particularly, there's a global oversupply. Simply making too much. And actually, it's not so much that we're making too much, it's that we're not drinking enough, which kind of leads on to our, or connects to our previous discussion about moderation. Yeah. But people are just drinking less. We actually had a small harvest last year, the smallest global harvest for wine in 60 years. But still, production is outstripping consumption because the younger generation just aren't drinking wine as they used to.
Mm. Are they drinking non-alcoholic wine? There was a lovely piece that you ran about April Fool's stories and particularly one about non-alcoholic wine.
Yeah, I mean, it's niche, non-alcoholic wine, but it's definitely a growth area. And it's one way to moderate your consumption is to be seen to be drinking the same thing with no alcohol in it. But it's small, really, I have to be honest. And that was poking fun at the trend. But the fact is that people across the board are just drinking a lot less. Partly that's health reasons, but a lot of it is economically motivated. It's quite expensive to drink. Mm. And us, I suppose, people sort of older generation, sort of baby boomers, people in their 50s, drink every day. But younger generation just drink on weekends or occasionally. And they drink good quality, high-priced products, but the volume is down.
Yeah, then they're certainly not drinking James May cheese gin, which was another April Fool that you spotted.
Yeah, I know. I think I showed a bit of humour from May. He's good value, but I mean, he is making his own gin, so it's drawing attention to that. But yeah, he's known for this cheese association, and he poked fun at that. And in fact, I thought I'd better check. And actually, you can get cheese that's infused with gin. But cheese gin is a whole different ballgame. Although there's almost any flavour you can find in cheese today, but yeah, that was a bit of savvy promotion by James May for his own gin on April Fool's.
Patrick, thank you very much indeed. That was Patrick Schmidt, and that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Laura Kramer. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.